Good morning, good morning. Sunday, April 6th, 2026, and Ava, I have to say there's a lot to get through today.
There really is. I was up until midnight going through this stack, and I kept thinking, okay, one more, one more. The range of material this week is genuinely wild. We've got defense tech, we've got systemic credit risk, we've got Hungary of all places.
Hun goody. We'll get there. But let's start where your brain goes first on a Sunday morning, money.
Andrew's natural habitat.
I'm a simple man. Okay, so let's start with something that I think is going to be the conversation of the year in defense and industrial policy. Over on the All In podcast this week, they had the executives from Palantir and Anduril, Shyam Sankar and Trey Stevens. And the headline number that stopped me cold was this. The United States has 8 days of munitions on hand for a major conflict with China. 8 days. Against 800 days needed.
That's not a gap. That's an abyss.
Right. And they also threw out a 10,000-to-1 drone production disadvantage versus China and a 2 to 3 times shipbuilding capacity gap. And the all-in guys framed this not as a capability problem, like our jets are worse or our soldiers are less trained, but as a pure industrial base problem. We forgot how to make things at scale.
Which makes the Anduril story so interesting. They're building this thing called Arsenal One, a 5 million square foot factory campus in Columbus, Ohio, and the explicit design goal is to avoid what happened with Stinger missiles and javelins in Ukraine. We ran out. And when we ran out, the assembly lines didn't exist anymore. The skilled workers were gone. So Arsenal One is modular. You can pivot the floor between drone types on demand.
And Shyam Sankar had this line that I keep turning over. He said, "It was always the factory. It was the ability to generate and regenerate the stockpile. That's the whole thing. Not the weapon. The factory."
The thing I found most fascinating in that all-in episode, though, and a little uncomfortable, was their argument about Silicon Valley's 20-year aversion to defense work. They're saying it wasn't purely organic. That CCP-funded organizations were actively protesting Palantir. That the Soviet Union spent something like $7 billion in today's dollars funding the Vietnam-era anti-war movement. They're arguing that the tech industry's conscience was, at least partially, manufactured.
That's a claim that deserves scrutiny. But I'll say this, Trey Stevens had a line that I thought was genuinely hard to dismiss. He said abstaining from building precision AI weapons isn't a morally neutral choice. You're not keeping your hands clean. You're just defaulting to less discriminate weapons. Less precise. More civilian casualties.
It reframes the whole ethics debate. Instead of, should I build this? The question becomes, what happens if I don't?
Exactly. And the market implication they're drawing is that defense tech is heading for a power law consolidation. 2 or 3 neoprimes, Anduril, Palantir, SpaceX, capturing most of the value, with hundreds of smaller VC-backed defense startups eventually fading out.
Which, if you believe the reindustrialization thesis, Columbus factories, critical minerals, domestic pharma, is actually a decades-long capex supercycle with defense as the demand anchor. That's a big macro call.
It is. And it connects to something Gina Raimondo was talking about over on Odd Lots with Bloomberg this week. She was specifically focused on Europe, but the industrial base theme is the same. Her argument is that China is running a playbook. She literally called it they run the play over and over again, flooding European markets with state-subsidized goods. German autos, German chemicals, getting hammered by imports that are up 20 to 30% year over year.
And the geopolitical wrinkle she added was that European politicians are tactically cozying up to China right now specifically to punish Trump, which she called self-destructive. China is exploiting that split to accelerate the dumping.
She was also notably candid about the CHIPS Act. She said TSMC is actually producing leading-edge chips in Arizona now, on par with Taiwan, targeting 20% of global leading-edge capacity by 2030. But the critical gaps are still there. Advanced packaging still goes back to Taiwan. Something like 30% of PCBs still imported from China. Most chip inputs still from Asia.
So we've reshared the headline, but not the supply chain underneath it.
Right. The tip of the iceberg is American, and everything below the waterline.
Still Beijing adjacent.
Her AI point was the one that stuck with me most, though. She said, and I'm almost quoting here, if all we have is the best models, the best chips, the biggest data centers, but sky-high unemployment and no transition system, that's not winning. That's automating America's decline.
Which connects directly to what Scott Galloway and Anish Raman were working through over on the Professor G Pod this week. Their whole conversation was about which human skills hold value in the AI transition. And the counterintuitive finding was that software engineering jobs are actually increasing right now, despite all the doom narratives. They use the ATM and bank teller analogy. Automation augments before it displaces, and the displacement often comes from a second-order technology nobody saw coming.
Smartphones killed bank tellers, not ATMs.
Exactly.
And Raman's point was that the most at-risk workers aren't entry-level. They're actually mid-career, high-salary people, the $400,000 employee whose compensation has outrun their marginal productivity relative to a cheaper, AI-native recent grad.
That's a brutal but probably accurate observation. And truck drivers are still the clearest near-term displacement. 40,000 preventable deaths per decade, which is the safety argument that eventually overrides the political resistance.
The Professor G framework for durable skills was this 5 C's thing: curiosity, compassion, creativity, courage, communication, which sound a little listicle why, but Galloway had this riff about creativity that I actually loved. He said your taste isn't a gift. It's what happens when you consume a lot, judge relentlessly, create consistently, and stick around long enough to get better. It's not lightning, he said.
It's reps.
I'll take that. Okay, let me throw in something from a completely different corner of the investing world before we get to the scary stuff. Over on Capital Allocators this week, Ted Seeds was talking with Bruce McDonald. He runs VCU's endowment, about $2.5 billion. And the operational stat that got me was that he does it with 5 people. 5 investment professionals.
How?
By deliberately excluding whole asset classes. No private credit, no China, no Latin America, no Africa. He calls it concentration of attention as a strategic choice. And he's only 20 to 25% in private assets versus most endowment peers who've gone much deeper into illiquids.
And his argument is that all that illiquid PE obsession actually removed a critical tool, the ability to buy dislocations. If everything is locked up in 10-year funds, you can't go countercyclical when markets crack.
He's been heavy in India since 2018, Vietnam more recently. Had a China specialist manager who pivoted there and told him it was exactly what he saw in China at a much smaller scale. In gold, initially as an emerging market currency hedge, but now he's leaning into it as a secular store of value call driven by geopolitical restructuring.
Which, honestly, given everything we're talking about this morning, makes a lot of sense.
And speaking of things that might crack, Ava, the Compound and Friends episode this week with Nick Namath. Did you get through that one?
I did, and I want to make sure we give it proper time, because it's either the most important warning of the year, or it's a very sophisticated bear case that doesn't quite land. Namath's thesis is about private credit and the life insurance system. He's arguing that private credit funds are self-marking their valuations at near par while public BDC equivalents, which hold essentially the same loans, are trading at 15 to 25% discounts. And he uses Blackstone's publicly traded BXSL as a real-time tell on what the private fund is actually worth.
And the stacking leverage argument is what makes it systemic. Something like 7 times EBITDA at the company level, 1.5 to 2 times at the fund level, up to 10 times in CLOs. All layered on top of each other.
And then you have 7 offshore reinsurers in Bermuda backstopping the balance sheets of roughly 680 U.S. life and annuity insurers, which collectively hold about $10 trillion in assets at 17 times leverage. And U.S. regulators apparently cannot examine the offshore books.
That's the detail that should make everyone sit up straight. The regulator cannot see the thing that's supposed to be the backstop.
The triggering mechanism Namath describes is a redemption spiral. Continued inflows have been masking credit deterioration. If inflows slow or reverse, funds have to sell their best assets first, which degrades NAV for everyone still in, which could trigger insurance company rating downgrades, which could force capital calls at the reinsurer level.
And you find out the backstop isn't there. Josh Brown had a great Socratic test for evaluating private fund pitches on that episode. Why me? If this is so good, why aren't the Saudis buying this whole thing? What do you need my clients for?
That's the question. The Animal Spirits episode this week actually had a more measured take on private credit. They said the BDC stress is real, but probably more like the commercial real estate hit to regional banks in 23. Painful, idiosyncratic, not necessarily systemic. Kevin Liniak was drawing that distinction.
Right. Over on Animal Spirits, they were actually more focused on momentum strategies and preferred securities. Bill Mann from Motley Fool was on, making the case that momentum is severely underallocated. He estimated something like $20 to $40 in value strategies for every $1 in momentum, despite momentum being a well-documented factor. Their fund, MFMO, launched in December of 2025.
The preferred securities pitch was interesting too. 6 to 6.5% yields, qualified dividend tax treatment. So capital gains rates, not ordinary income, and the fixed to floating rate structure keeps duration low in a way most fixed income products don't. Utilities issued $25 billion in preferreds last year because rating agencies let them count it as equity for regulatory purposes.
Cheaper than equity doesn't dilute shareholders. It's a smart structure if rates stay elevated.
All right, let's move to tech and AI because the A16Z podcast had a conversation this week with Peter Yang. He's a PM at Roblox, and it got into some territory I've been thinking about a lot. Their framing was about how coding agents are collapsing the app grid into conversation. And Peter Yang uses this open source Claude agent called OpenClaw for about 80% of his daily AI interaction via voice and Telegram. And his argument is that 80% of the value is the UX layer, the feels like a person quality, not the underlying model capabilities.
Wait, really? The interface matters more than a model?
That's his take. And it maps to a broader argument he makes about which apps survive the agent transition. Task completion apps, calendar, analytics, lightweight CRM, those face real substitution risk because agents can just do the task without you ever opening the app. But entertainment and connection apps, Twitter, TikTok, those are stickier because you open them to feel something, not accomplish something.
That's actually a useful framework. And the SaaS angle is interesting. He's saying AI native companies are already vibe coding internal replacements for software they pay for. The calculus shifts when you have surplus coding agent capacity and the SaaS tool is simple enough to replicate.
The company structure argument is where it gets genuinely radical. He thinks the default is 2 to 3% product team plus agents rather than a bloated 10% team, and that small teams stay aligned without the OKR theater that degrades large organizations as they scale.
And the A16Z guys pushed back with a point about human ambition. Anish Acharya had this line, "Human ambition has no ceiling," because human desire has no ceiling. The idea that productivity gains don't destroy work, they just change its shape.
Which loops back to the Professor G conversation about durable skills and the Raimondo concern about transition systems. Everyone's grappling with the same underlying question. The tools are here. The displacement is starting. Where does all that human energy go?
Okay, let's get to geopolitics, and you're going to lead this because it is deeply your wheelhouse.
So Peter Zeihan put out two videos this week that I think are worth taking together. The first one is about the Strait of Hormuz and the question everyone in energy markets is asking, can a British-led coalition reopen it if Iran shuts it down? And Zeihan's answer was he was laughing.
Not a good sign.
He said only three navies in the world have meaningful power projection capability to reach the Persian Gulf from home, the US, the UK, and Japan. France is borderline. Every other country gave up deep water naval capability under the post-World War II American security umbrella because they didn't need it. And even if you combined all allied navies, their total firepower would probably be less than what the U.S. already has on station.
So the coalition is a press release.
A political gesture, not a military solution. And the harder problem is the Iranian threat geometry, drones and land-based missiles that extend 200 to 600 miles from coastline. To escort ships through, you'd have to physically secure the Iranian coastline, which Zeihan compared to securing everything from New York City to Savannah. He said the U.S. Army could maybe do that. Nobody else comes close.
So what's the actual market implication? Oil supply disruption risk with no credible military resolution?
That's his frame. He actually floated a toll system framing, like Iran has essentially institutionalized the choke point and ships are already adapting to it rather than being stopped entirely. The best case scenario he described, Trump withdraws completely, Iran lets it go, he openly said is implausible.
And his second video this week was about European trade architecture, which is almost darkly funny if you're paying attention to it.
The EU-Mercosur deal, covering Brazil, Argentina, the whole bloc, was negotiated starting around 2001. They finished it recently. 25 years. The EU-Canada deal took about 11 years. The EU-Australia deal was actually negotiated in record time, under a year. But ratification requires sign-off from every member state, some of which require regional legislatures, some require referendums. And Zaihin's punchline was that even in the ideal scenario, the first large-scale transfer of Australian goods to the European market would happen in 2040.
He said, and this is the quote I want, I'm not going to be doing this long enough for that to matter.
And the structural point underneath, it is that Europe's multi-layer ratification process isn't a bug or a temporary dysfunction. It's a feature of how the EU was designed. It makes the EU fundamentally incapable of being a nimble trade actor regardless of geopolitical urgency.
Which means all the talk of Europe as an alternative pole in a post-American trade order is largely theater, because they also can't project the naval power to secure those trade routes.
Zaihin is pretty consistent on that. Without U.S. naval projection, European trade beyond its immediate periphery has no security guarantee. It's a related problem to the Hormuz situation.
Okay, last one before we wrap. The Economist this week had a great briefing on Hungary in the April 12th election. Walk me through it.
So the challenger is Peter Magyar, 45, former Fidesz insider. He defected in early 2024 and built his party, TISA, from nothing to 30% of the vote in EU elections within months. The whole Hungarian opposition has coalesced behind him, which is historically unprecedented.
And Orbán's vulnerability is the economy?
That's the key pressure point. Hungary GDP grew just 0.4% in 2025 versus 3.6% in Poland. The EU has blocked about 16 billion euros in aid. The Economist estimated that's cut at least a percentage point off annual growth. And the EU treaty mechanism to sanction Orbán requires unanimity, so he just needs one ally, currently Slovakia's Fico, to block it permanently.
The global implication is what makes it a bellwether story. The Economist European editor made the point that Orbán's playbook directly inspired Project 2025 and MAGA governance strategies. If Magyar wins, it proves that competitive authoritarian systems can be reversed electorally. If he loses,
it validates the model as durable. And Magyar's political positioning is deliberately vague, center-right, not ideologically coherent. His appeal is more psychological than policy-driven, which is either the genius of it or the fragility.
The information environment detail was the one I found most interesting. Hungary apparently has the lowest foreign language fluency in the EU, which means Orbán's media capture is self-reinforcing even without overt censorship. Citizens just can't easily access outside news.
Structural information barrier. That's actually a scarier form of control than overt censorship because it's nearly invisible.
All right, let's do our what we're watching quick fire before we get out of here.
I'm watching the Hungary election on April 12th. It really is a global signal.
I'm watching redemption flows in private credit funds, specifically whether the gates that have already started triggering at the 5% threshold start to accelerate. That's the early warning on the compound thesis.
I'm watching whether Gina Raimondo's warning about European industrial equities gets priced in. The market narrative is still dominated by the NATO defense spending story, but the Chinese import surge into Germany is a separate and potentially larger structural problem.
And I'm watching the Columbus factory. Endural breaks ground on Arsenal 1. That's a multi-year tell on whether the reindustrialization thesis is real or it's just a great conference slide.
That's the one I want to be wrong about being skeptical of.
Why?
Because if it's real, it's actually important. Not just as a trade, as a thing.
Fair enough. All right, that's Morning Signal for Sunday, April 6th. Thanks for spending your morning with us. Go enjoy the rest of your weekend. We'll be back tomorrow.
Stay curious, everybody.